Leif Erikson sailed across the sea, the millennium's very first hero, while Sidraha in India discovered the number zero. The church split up in 1054, Catholic and Orthodox forevermore. The Norman conquest took the British Isle, while the Ming dynasty started in style. Some Christians went on the big crusades, fighting and killing and singing, while others stayed at home and prayed, like Hildegard of Bingen. St. Francis, St. Clair, and Genghis Khan, and the Magna Carta with old King John. The tower in Pisa took a dip and a lurch, but Notre Dame is a pretty nice church. The Aztecs came to Mexico in 1260, plus or minus. And Cambridge U started up to go. We heard from Rumi and Thomas Aquinas. Marco Polo took a shopping trip and found stuff that couldn't be finer. And the Ottoman Empire took control of the ship all around Asia Minor. Popes and princes fought a lot, but their reasons were kind of vague. And then in 1347...
Bubonic Plague.
And with that bubonic plague intro, welcome to Connections Radio Show, where we talk about ideas that matter. And what you listen to is some ideas there that we've got to trollop through some centuries there.
Some centuries, right?
Well, welcome to Connections Radio Show. I'm Lori Fitz, your host, and the goal of our show is to explore a wide range of topics that challenge us to see ourselves, our community, and the world around us, as well as the history of the world, to get us thinking and get us connected and perhaps inspired or challenged a bit to do a little bit more because we've made the connection. And our topic today is art and spirituality and the history of the Christian world.
Somewhat, yeah.
Rick, you brought a guest. Yeah, Rick Bernardo, my co-host, you brought a guest.
That's me. And the reason we heard the thing about that ended with the bubonic plague is Steve Garness Holmes was part of the group that did this, the Montana Logging and Ballet Company. I went to school, graduate school in theology with Steve, and that was my formative years. Steve, I got to say, I tell people Pacific School of Religion and the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley was like the MASH television show, good people doing good, amazing work with a good amount of partying and cross-dressing. So good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Garness Holmes, we're glad that you're with us today.
It's good to be here. It's kind of fun to reconnect with Rick after 40 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Wandering in the wilderness. Wow.
I enjoyed our conversation to prepare for our show today, and you have come to our show as both a minister or a retired minister, as well as an artist who explored art and spirituality and continues to explore art and spirituality. Tell us a little bit about your time at the Pacific. What brought you to art through there?
You know, it's just always in my blood. I don't know if any artist of any sort could say what brought them there other than they were sort of, you know, that was the river they were on and they suddenly discovered they were in the ocean. I think part of it, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning, the relationship between art and spirituality, for me, it's kind of interesting. I grew up in a church household, so to speak. I'm a preacher's kid. I'm the sixth generation Methodist minister's kid.
Oh, my goodness.
Methodist minister, and my dad's side of the family, I think it's a genetic disease. It's in the family. They're looking into it. But fortunately, my kids have stopped the madness in this generation. So
stop the madness.
But, you know, the interesting thing was my dad was a Methodist minister, but it wasn't what you would think of as a particularly religious household. We didn't pray together. We didn't talk about religion. It just kind of was in the air. And I did a lot of my theologizing on my own, essentially, in my head. And early on, it seemed to me that God is more of a mystery than a thing. And it sounds like we'll get into some of that discussion later. But early on, I began to realize that that there is a dimension of life that is beyond our dualistic thinking, beyond our analyzing and explaining and understanding. And it, you know, you can look at a sunset, and if you want, you can talk about the refraction of light and the spectrum of light and reflections and cloud cover and particulate matter in the atmosphere. Or you can just look at a sunset and go, oh, wow.
It's pretty.
And so I came at religion saying, how do we do the oh, wow part and still have language to talk about it? Yeah. And that's where you go to seminary. So you learn the tradition, you learn how to study the Bible and all that stuff. But they were linked in my mind. The things I was learning was linked to how you stay in that wow mode. How you stay connected with wonder and mystery and awe and grace and love at the same time that you explain it in a way that you can write a paper or whatever. And of course, the meaning of that for me is what ministry ought to be about. You know, preaching a sermon isn't explaining things. It's helping open people's eyes so they see the sunset and go, oh, wow.
Yeah.
And when you speak of the sunset, I think of when I was a kid also, Northern California, having horses and would love to look at sunsets and sunrises on horseback. I always felt like God was a creator in terms of God was an artist, you know, that and mm-hmm. all was creative. It all was part of creation. And when you were part of the creation, when you were really part of the creativity, that there was creativity all around us in the creation of the earth, of us, of our animals, of our land, of our plants.
Yeah.
And that's the wonder as well. You know?
It's so much a part of being human is this it's kind of a miracle when you think of it, that we can have a vision or an idea and it's not there, it's not real, but we can create it. And mm-hmm. it could be an experience, it could be an object, it could be a whole nation, it could be anything. Mm-hmm. It could be science, and it's the first image of Adam and Eve is really in God's image as a creative force. Mm-hmm. I mean, anytime I try to make sense of that, and I read and I do the theology, kind of goes back to that. It's kind of more like, how do we create sunsets, and how does that happen anyway?
In looking at art as poetry and what you bring in music and poetry and what, had you done poetry from the beginning in looking at your relationship with God and your relationship of exploring what spirituality? And tell me, you have a nice distinction about what spirituality is.
Yes, for me, spirituality is it's one of those words that's become so ubiquitous that it has 4,000 definitions and they all average out to cold oatmeal. but for me, spirituality means our relationship and our intentional relationship with what really is, with a capital I. That's your spirituality. How do you connect with what is beyond all of our habits and assumptions and ideas and beliefs, but what just plain is? And for me, a religion is an intentional practice of spirituality. When people say, oh, I'm spiritual but not religious, usually what they mean is, I haven't thought about it much. because if you're really spiritual, there's a practice to that. You have to practice that spirituality. You know, I often, when I talk about poetry, I'll say poetry is 95% paying attention and 5% taking really good notes. And I think spirituality is that paying attention part. And religion is how we take notes, how we practice that. What are the stories we tell? What are the habits and the rituals and the practices that we engage in order to keep our antennas open to what is? And yeah, I practiced that early on. I don't know when I first started writing poetry. Well, I remember in fourth grade, writing poetry. And it was, you know, what you might expect from a fourth grader. It was pretty terrible poetry. except that it was my attempt to get at what I was experiencing, what I saw in the world. And in that sense, there's no such thing as bad poetry, you know, if you're being honest.
Yeah. Speaking of which, religion can get a bad name because there are institutionalized religions that, just like any human being or community or any institution, can do terrible things. And yet the word religion, what is it? It originally meant to bind or connect. Speaking of connections,
yeah,
radio.
Related to the word ligament.
Yeah. Ligament. There you go. It comes from that word. Yeah. Religio, whatever it was in Latin or something. That phenomenon of sharing spirituality becomes some sort of religion, but may not have buildings associated with it, or may.
Right. Yeah. And everybody practices some kind of religion. You know, the people who say, well, I walk in the woods, that's my religion. Well, actually, that is.
Yeah.
It might be pretty shallow, and it might be pretty uninformed, and it might not have much in the way of roots in tradition, but everybody has something that to them connects them with what makes sense of the world. And honestly, for some people, their religion really is shopping or sports or being right. I've made a 40-year career of preaching over and over and over again. There are two religions in the world. All of human beings practice one of these two religions. One is the religion of being right, and the other is the religion of being in love.
Oh.
Either you figure out the rules and you do what you need to do to get what you want, or you just fall in love. And sooner or later, if you're in love, you're going to break the rules. And sooner or later, if you follow all the rules, you're going to hurt somebody. You have to choose one or the other. And part of what Jesus was about was noticing that and saying, choose the religion of being in love. He quoted Hosea more than once and said that God says, I desire mercy, not sacrifice.
Wow.
I want you to be in love, not do all the right religious rigmarole.
And I want to circle back, because I first met Steve at Pacific School of Religion, and he and I, in a lesser version, were doing these cabaret nights or coffee house, and I got to witness Steve play music on the piano, on the guitar, do poetry, do comedy, create in our experience in the moment a musical instrument made of hoses and funnels, all kinds of things. And that was him already living out this sort of in the moment creativity, and it was just marvelous. But that's why we're going to be hearing more from of his life experience with this sort of creative experience.
I love the idea that there's two religions, either being right or being in love. And it takes a nice dimension when, you know, God is love. And that has so many, you know, different dimensions to it. But our connection then to God is, you know, is our connection one of love, or is our connection of being right?
And exactly.
And in that being right connection, some of the intro, the crazy things that can happen when we want to believe we are right.
Yeah. And you know, the interesting thing is that if you set all of the major world religions side by side, the interesting thing that is among all of them, the fundamentalists all speak exactly the same language.
Interesting.
These are
the
rules. God is in charge. There's a hierarchy. And in all of them, men are above women. People of my race are above people of other races. We're all above the animals, which is above the dirt. I mean, there's strict hierarchy, all these rules that you have to get right. And you know, whether they're Baptists or Shiites, they all have exactly the same fundamentalism. And among all religions, the mystics are also exactly talking about the same thing. They're saying it's all about love and forgiveness and enlightenment.
And mystery,
And the unfolding light. I bring up unfolding light because you have a great website, unfoldinglight.net. I'm Oh, looks like Rick wants to say something. Go for it.
We want to listen to another minute of the millennial rap. We're going to be listening to this, by the way. It's going to be framing our segments. And this is a tour through history. Maybe when we come back, we'll get more from Steve as how the heck was this created. This is another section from the Millennium Rap.
And after this Millennium Rap, we'll be making a rap with this first segment.
Yeah.
We'll be back shortly.
We'll be back.
Joan of Arc had a special spark. There was Catherine of Siena. The popes had the Jews against the ropes from Lisbon to Vienna. The Mayans built their temples tall while the Chinese folk restored their wall. Gutenberg made prints and fonts just in time for the Renaissance. Albrecht Dürer drew those hands. Columbus sailed for foreign lands. Henry VIII became the king. And Leonardo da Vinci did everything. Michelangelo, Erasmus, Sir Thomas More, and Martin Luther pounding on the door. The moguls ran India everywhere they looked, and the Arabs sold coffee, and they got us all hooked. Along came old Copernicus, said the center of the world wasn't us. Sir Francis Drake, Vasco da Gama, Don Quixote in Shakespeare's drama.
And past Venus, Venus roots on ice dunes.
They burned those witches left and right, after kissing them goodnight. Then Africa shed blood and tears as slaves were sold 300 years. Montezuma's empire was pretty vast, but Spain made sure it didn't last. They robbed the Incas and left them with nada, then got their due in a sunken armada. Queen Elizabeth and Pocahontas, the Inquisition whose evils haunt us. They cornered Mr. Galileo and said, "Please tell us that it ain't so. You'll want to agree, because this fire's hot." So he said, "It ain't so, not." King Louis the First and Second and Third and Fourth and Fifth, you've already heard John Donne and Kepler and Isaac Newton, Vivaldi singing and plucking and tooting, Teresa Prade and Rembrandt.
And welcome back to Connections Radio Show, where we talk about ideas that matter. And what you just heard was some fun millennium rap with our friend Stephen Garness Holmes. And Stephen has just written a book. It's coming out soon. And it is the same name as his website. And why don't you share that with us?
Unfolding Light. And the website is unfoldinglight.net. I'm not sure there's going to be a net over the book or not. But
hello, Steve. Thank you for joining us for this next segment.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for providing this great thing.
In our last segment, we had started to talk about two religions. Either a religion of love or a religion of right or rightness. And when you were explaining it, and if you've missed it, audience, you can go back and listen to our podcast because it's excellent. In thinking about God is right or God is love, it seems to me that there's a desire when we have a God that is right, it's a little bit easier because you've got a rule book. Of right and wrong that you can just follow. And if you follow the rule book and behave, all will be well. And when you don't behave, you're out of order. And when you're out of order, you threaten, you know, everlasting life, you know, potentially. How does that sense of easiness, but in many ways it's really hard to follow all the rules, but there's an easiness of like a life direction versus, you know, being in sort of a complex world of having to make decisions based on many other factors that aren't about rules.
You know, part of the sneaky thing about how easy it is that it seems like human beings, as a part of our very nature, are incapable of trusting that we're okay. There's a fancy and about 97% misusable theological term for that, which is original sin. It doesn't mean that we're bad.
Yeah.
It means that in our very guts, we don't know how to trust that we are beloved, that there is this infinite love that holds us. Because we don't trust that, we spend our lives basically trying to earn it, trying to hang on to it, trying to, like I say, prove that we're right, that we're deserving, that we're the righteous ones who need to go to heaven. And that doubt nags at us so much that we essentially gaslight ourselves
into
thinking, well, I don't really deserve to go to heaven, but I'm going to just make sure that I do anyway. And that doubt makes it seem right for us to keep on trying to be right. And it makes it feel like the easy way. And the way of trusting that we are beloved feels a lot more challenging.
And
so in some ways, it feels easier to just follow the rules,
right?
Even if we know we're going to mess up.
But underneath that is a deservability, right?
And there's so much acting out that comes from that lack of a spiritual self-esteem. And we're born into a world that has created a lot of that sort of going off the rails. And that's another aspect of original sin that seems to make sense. We're already born into a world that's got racism and so forth. So we can't not be part of it. So that's originating. But it's not the depth and breadth of who we really are is what I hear you saying. And as a teacher of ethics for years, there's a word right and wrong can just mean how we're behaving. And it's good to aim for that. Like, you know, how do we learn what's the right thing to do? How do we live from the depth of that being? But it doesn't mean ego-driven, I got to be right, like you're talking about.
Yeah, it's more, you know, it's interesting in the Bible talks a lot about righteousness. And of course, in our religion of trying to be right, we say, oh, that means being right. But what righteousness really means is harmonious relationship. And when I think about being in harmony, that to me is what faith is all about. That's what religion is all about, is being in harmony with God. And of course, I'm always out of tune. You know, and ask any musician and they'll tell you, when people are singing out of tune, it's precisely because they think they're in tune. And it's only when we stop and listen and tune up and say, I might be out of tune, so I need to sing in tune. When we listen, then we tune up. The mystery to me is that in my theological story of Christianity, it's a story of how God says, I will make ours a harmonious relationship, even though you are off the rails. I will come stand next to you and create that harmony for you. And all you have to do is accept it. That's real different than this sense that you have to get it right. You just have to allow what is already there to be there, to just receive. And that notion of receiving grace, to me, is the difference between getting it right and being in love.
And when you talk about music, I think of the Montana Logging and Ballet. Tell us a little bit about that.
We were a quartet of us, my brother and I and two other guys, that all went to Rocky Mountain College in Billings, Montana, back in the 70s. And the other two guys were actually 10 years older. They had been in a group for years called the People Tree. They were in L.A. They did Hollywood. They were on TV. And they just weren't getting anywhere. So they quit, came back to Rocky and said, let's form a group. So the four of us got together and we did this thing that eventually became the Montana Logging and Ballet Company, whose name was kind of funny. Reporters would interview us and say, so where did you come up with that name? And you could just see in the way they asked the question that they thought there was an answer to that question.
And I would say,
well, actually, we were involved in a minor misdemeanor and the judge sentenced us instead of jail to some community service time and thought we'd be useless. So instead sentenced us to carrying around a meaningless name for 37 years.
Yeah,
and the reporter would say, really? And I would say, no, actually, what it really was we combined all the letters of all of our names, including our middle names, and it spelled something really dirty. So we changed it to the Montana Logging and Ballet Company. And they would say, really?
Thanks for clarifying.
No, you idiot. It's a name that says we're doing something silly and ridiculous. You should come hear us.
I love that you make up stories to satisfy an answer that is absurd to begin with.
Yeah.
Sounds like the Beatles interviews.
Celebrating absurdity is great.
Yeah, so we did music and comedy for 37 years, started in the late 70s. And partly in Montana, but around the country, we played for Congress and played with Tutu and played for little tiny, you know, library fundraisers and a lot of because we're, as long as the name is, it's still a no-name group. And so it's not like you just put up a poster and say the Rolling Stones and everybody would show up. So mostly what we played for was either art series that subscribers would just show up to the next show for, or conventions and conferences for groups that might want to hear the kind of thing that we had to say. A lot of teachers, a lot of labor groups, environmental groups. And we did that in our spare time. All four of us had day jobs, and we just did that in our squeeze time for 30 flipping 7 years.
Oh, it's, and it's so delightful. Anybody look up Montana Logging and Ballet Company on the web. There's not a lot of groups with that name or shows, maybe just one. There's actually a PBS special of your, I think it was your final show. It's got the whole thing. Mm-hmm. It's zany and beautiful, or beautiful and zany.
You know, That was what we were specifically trying for. We could have just been a rock and roll group and done music, and we could have just been a comedy troupe and done some fun stuff. But one of the things we really wanted to do was essentially, we couldn't just go out there and say, what we're going to do is preach the good news. What we wanted to do was give people a sense that the power of love is greater than the power of fear or hate or violence or anything else. But you can't just go and say, we're going to preach this sermon and you're going to love it. So what we would do is mix music and comedy in a way that was gorgeous music, good, nice, tight, four-part harmony, and also this ridiculous comedy that was just kind of off the wall.
Well, we want to we want to share some of that. We've got Light in Our Eyes that we'll be sharing. And we're going to come back after the song and talk a little bit about that. But I want the audience to be able to experience Light in Our Eyes.
In all our dreaming, the world is open, open. We are not dreaming, our eyes are open, open. With all our hearts, we are hoping, hoping. With all our hands, we are hoping, hoping. In all our dreaming, the world is open, open. We are not dreaming, our eyes are open, open. With all our hearts, we are hoping, hoping. With all our hands, we are hoping, hoping.
You know, interesting thing about that song, it's among a little handful in which I, in my 40 years as a pastor, wrote a lot of worship music, a lot of hymns for the congregation to sing. And sometimes I would just write new words to familiar tunes so that they could just launch right in and sing it to the tune of Morning is Broken or something like that. But a lot of times I would write original tunes. And a few times what I did is stole those tunes from either the stage or the church to use in the other setting. I would just write a different set of words. And this is one of those. We could sing that on stage, and it's just a song about hope. I also have one called Eternal Life that you can actually buy the sheet music on my website that's a hymn for the congregation to sing with that tune, but it's a reflection on a passage from the first letter of John, in which he talks about, we know that we've passed from death to life because we love one another. So there were a couple of those that I did. There was one a Jamaican tune with kind of a nice calypso feel about being in the boat with Jesus. And I stole the tune, put together a different bridge, and used it on stage as a song about our national energy policy.
I love that. It's like two sides of the river. You know, you have the riverbank on one side and the riverbank on the other, but they both flow with the love and they both flow with the hope.
And you know, there is a there's a theological reason for that, and it has to do with humor, actually. And I know this is foreign and uncomfortable for Rick to talk about, but let's talk about humor.
It's his favorite, as you know.
As we know. the thing is, one sort of rise to a higher level to do is to sort of rise to a higher level and hold both of those things in our heads at the same time. You know, probably the simplest form is a pun, right? In which you use a word that's in one context supposed to mean something, but it sounds like something else. And you've got to hold those two things together. Spirituality is that work of holding the paradox, of letting something be this and also not that at the same time.
I'm just wondering if laughter is the reaction of forced transcendence. Like, you know, the clash of ideas goes, bah! You know.
And what I hear from it is it's the ultimate connections. How do we make the connections to things that are so separate? But when you do have that aha moment, whether it's a giggle or a gasp of beauty, it creates something more.
And we counted on that with Montana Long and the Ballet Company. You know, if you really listen to a good recording of our live performances, we're not all those great musicians. A lot of times we're out of tune and weren't quite all together. But what we did on stage was that people experienced four guys who really loved each other sharing their joy together, honestly and vulnerably, in a way that would sweep them up and allow them to be at ease. And then we could hit them with some kind of hard political stuff, fairly left-leaning political satire. And after our show, more than once, people would come up to us and say, you know, I hate your guys' politics, but I love listening to you.
That's a good comment.
I think that's sort of the prophetic way, you know, to suck people into this kind of forced transcendence, to kind of
suck them into joy.
Sucker. Toss them to a higher level where, against their will, they have to see a different perspective and hold this paradox in their minds. And then, of course, settle back down to earth and then from then on make choices.
And with that, I'm going to have us pause so we can go to commercial break, which they always are grateful that I do that. but I want to stay on that theme in terms of politics and rightness versus love that we are living, especially during this election year, and some of the distortions how the rightness can create a lot of distortions and what can we do to keep that love. Right now, Martin Luther King's center is doing a whole campaign on be love. And how does that being love make a difference? So,
and this is just another 30 seconds of the Millennium Rap.
John Wesley's heart got set afire. Georg Handel wrote Messiah. Hasidic Jews raised prayer a little higher. And Catherine the Great built the Russian Empire. The Industrial Revolution got off the ground. America's colonies came unbound. They learned from the Indians who lived around and wrote a constitution that still is sound.
Mozart wrote some music that we quote. Class that lasts, though centuries may pass.
King Louis and Marie Antoinette experienced a revolution. They never have recovered yet. They lost their heads in all the confusion.
taught us to sing between our lives.
The Great Depression, Charlie Chaplin, the Holocaust, World War II, Hiroshima, the UN, Rosa Parks and Elvis Presley too, Castro in Cuba, China and Tibetan, John F. Kennedy, the Armstrongs, both Neil and Louis, Walter Cronkite and TV, the Communists, the Beatles and Martin Luther King, Mao Tse-tung and Nixon and that Cold War pandering, Woodstock and airlines flying and rockets to the moon and Mars, ban the nukes, species dying and the planet eaten alive by cars, maps that shifted weekly from adding brand new nations as European colonies achieved their liberation. Pablo Casals, Wounded Knee, Simon and Garfunkel, Troubled Waters, Gloria Steinem's writings that made inroads for our daughters.
World music on the radio. We're a global village now.
And welcome back to Connections Radio Show. If you've been with us throughout the hour, you have been hearing the world through these delightful snippets of the Millennium Rap. And providing that to us is Steve Garness Holmes, author of the book Unfolding Light, that will be soon available for us to all buy, and a good friend of Rick Bernardo, who's our co-host.
Yes, and one of the ways I've stayed a little more aware of Steve's work since our graduation many decades ago of Pacific School of Religion is his unfoldinglight.net website. And we were just talking, Steve, about humor, and I don't know if I've ever shared with you the Quincy Jones quote that he wrote on the back of Richard Pryor's autobiography. He said, "I've always seen laughter as the soul's way of shouting, ain't that the truth?" And so there's something not only joyous and beautiful about humor, but it's and we were talking about I said it's almost like forcing us to transcend and get another view of something. But there's that depth of truth going on there where people are open to it more in your work. As I was saying, it's a combination of zaniness and beauty.
And see, we were go ahead. You go.
John, the Gospel of John starts out, in the beginning was the Word. And when we translate that word, logos, out of the Greek, usually what we mean by that is something akin to the sense or the logic of it. But there's a sense in the original that logos doesn't mean word as a one-way thing. It's a conversation.
It's a connection.
In the beginning was the word that we were sharing together. And there is something truthful about that conversation back and forth between what we think we know and what's actually true. And we laugh because they don't quite match up. And that's where the laughter happens, when we go, oh, wait, there's something even more true than what I thought was true.
but what happens when we're not making that connection, and that there seems almost to be two conversations? We talked about the sense of rightness versus, you know, the religion of love. And when each other's religion antagonizes each other, it's a distortion. So help me with that.
You know, one of the things I appreciate about the Christian story is that it takes seriously the political setting of our religious being. If I were to boil Jesus's message down to one thing that he would spend his life doing, it's this: God is pure love, and that love is for everybody. There's no such thing as deserving. All of our judgments of who is good and who is bad, who is righteous and unrighteous, clean and unclean, all of those are faulty, because we all receive infinite love from God. Like the sun just gives light and heat. There's no darkness. God just gives light and just gives love. There's no punishment. And people say, well, you have to have punishment. But the cause of our sin is our lack of trust, and the way God heals that is to give us what we can trust and allow us to get to that point. And Jesus knew perfectly well that when he preached this message, that everybody is equally deserving of God's love and receiving of God's love. That would upset the people whose livelihoods depended on the hierarchy, the people who owned the systems of privilege and exclusion. That's the story of the cross. The story of Jesus saying, love is universal, salvation is universal, this is for everybody, stop making all these stupid rules. And the world says, nope, we're making more rules. And the first thing we're doing is we're crucifying you for saying what you did. And of course, the resurrection is Jesus, is God's way of turning that whole thing into a April Fool's joke and saying, ha, 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 guess what? Jesus was right. Love is actually more powerful than all that other hoo-ha.
A question in here for you, though, and we only have a few minutes left, but it's one that I'm deeply interested in your reaction. There's so many that are now turned off by Christianity.
Sure.
Because of what is being represented as Christianity. And what is your feeling about that?
Well, a lot of what's being resented is the exact polar opposite of what Jesus was talking about. A lot of that, what claims to be evangelical, which is a word that's supposed to be rooted in good news, is the bad news that if you've got it right, then you get to go to heaven, and all these other things make it so that you don't have it right. That's exactly the opposite of what Jesus was saying. And it's a gross distortion. And when we argue about that and say, so what's really Christian and what's really not Christian, I think Jesus would be really clear.
And Steve, say
that again. Jesus would be really clear. What would he say?
Jesus would be clear that what's authentically Christian is mercy for everybody, 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 no exceptions.
And grace.
And anybody who, well, all of us do to some degree, we react against that. There are the MAGA folks who say, well, it's not the immigrants and not the gays and not that stuff. And you know what? I have to admit, I say it's the MAGA folks. Mm-hmm. We all play that game. And Jesus says, nope, it's for everybody. And to me, that's the real crucial razor blade that you can use to dissect when we're talking about what's true to Christianity. What offers freedom and power to absolutely everybody? And what restricts it to some people and not others?
And Steve, I just wanted to say thank you for being another example of what religion can be and what spirituality can be. And I don't know anybody that you and I went to school with who is other than that. Really?
Yeah, we were lucky. We had some pretty good classmates. It was a pretty good time.
And with that, I just want to do a good plug for the unfoldinglight.net. You'll find all sorts of wonderful pieces there to consider and to share and to contemplate of love. And your book coming out, and is it coming out in May, did you say?
I think in May.
Coming out in late May, a book of 184 poems over the last 45 years of writing poems. Picked a few out of my few thousand few of my favorites.
Well, terrific.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
And we hope that you'll come back again. This is going to be a tough year, and I think we need all the love our country can get during this challenging time. And your words are inspiring and thoughtful and create the connections that I hope will make us a better place.
Sweet.